Welcome back. We're still working in the Life Divine. We're on chapter 28, The Divine Life, the last chapter of his magnum opus. When we put a semicolon last week in our study, he was describing that the discovery of the truth of our individual being brings us into oneness, into a shared reciprocity, into a harmony, unity, mutuality, harmony, which are characteristic of our realized individual nature, but also of the collective nature in which we would live in a Gnostic society, in a world where truth attained a signal victory over darkness and ignorance. And he brings back this idea of a supernature, Paraprakriti in the Gita, which must reveal itself as the hidden, secret, true nature behind the appearances and the facade of what we ordinarily take to be nature in its entirety. In other words, there is a nature greater than the material, the vital, and the mental. So we continue. This is the whole sense and the inherent law and necessity of the passage from the purely mental and material being in life to the spiritual and supramental being in life, that the liberation, perfection, self-fulfillment for which the being in the ignorance is seeking can only be reached by passing out of his present nature of ignorance into a nature of spiritual self-knowledge and world knowledge. Because, again, both individual and cosmos are expressions of a transcendence, and that knowledge is one in nature. This greater nature we speak of as supernature because it is beyond his actual level of consciousness and capacity. But in fact, it is his own true nature, the height and completeness of it to which he must arrive if he is to find his real self and whole possibility of being. Whatever happens in nature must be the result of nature. The effectuation of what is implied or inherent in it, its inevitable fruit and consequence. If our nature is a fundamental in conscience and ignorance, arriving with difficulty at an imperfect knowledge, an imperfect formulation of consciousness and being, the results in our being, life, and action and creation must be, as they now are, a constant imperfection and insecure half-result, an imperfect mentality, an imperfect life, an imperfect physical existence. We seek to construct systems of knowledge and systems of life by which we can arrive at some perfection of our existence, some order of right relations, right use of mind, right use and happiness and beauty of life, right use of the body. And these are all values of Satchit Ananda, implicit in the manifestation of a cosmos. But what we achieve is a constructed half-rightness mixed with much that is wrong and unlovely and unhappy. Our successive constructions, because of the vice in them, and because mind and life cannot rest permanently anywhere in their seeking, are exposed to destruction, decadence, disruption of their order, and we pass from them to others which are not more finally successful or enduring, even if on one side or another they may be richer and fuller or more rationally plausible. It cannot be otherwise, because we can construct nothing which goes beyond our nature. Imperfect, we cannot construct perfection. However wonderful may seem to us the machinery our mental ingenuity invents, however externally effective. Ignorant, we cannot construct a system of entirely true and fruitful self-knowledge or world knowledge. Our science itself is a construction, a mass of formulas and devices. Masterful in knowledge of processes and in the creation of apt machinery, but ignorant of the foundations of our being and of world being, it cannot perfect our nature and therefore cannot perfect our life. Still true. So is the inconscient the origin, or is the superconscient the origin? And again, Sri Aurobindo is sort of setting this argument up so that eventually we could refer fruitfully again to the idea of the cosmic tree, the Ashwatha tree, whose roots are above and whose branches extend below. So there is a para prakriti, a super nature, and it's our own true nature, because even in the Gita, several thousand years ago, it's formulated that the jiva bhuta, the real core individual being who rises out of the oneness of para prakriti, is an expression, a radiant expression of that, not divorced from it. So the soul has a nature, and that nature is a super light. So in essence, we always carry that with us, and it is part of our supreme nature. Yes, it is our supreme nature too. So he continues, our nature, our consciousness, is that of beings ignorant of each other, separated from each other, rooted in a divided ego, who must strive to establish some kind of relation between their embodied ignorances. For the urge to union and forces making for union are there in nature. Individual and group harmonies of a comparative and qualified completeness are created. A social cohesion is accomplished. But in the mass, the relations formed are constantly marred by imperfect sympathy, imperfect understanding, gross misunderstandings, strife, discord, unhappiness. It cannot be otherwise, so long as there is no true union of consciousness founded upon a nature of self-knowledge, inner mutual knowledge, inner realization of unity, concord of our inner forces of being and inner forces of life. So we see one shared nature of true beings starting spiritually, soul deep, radiating through the subliminal being into the actualities of our external structure. And not simply in the individual, but in the collective as well. In our social building, we labor to establish some approach to unity, mutuality, harmony, because without these things, there can be no perfect social living. But what we build is a constructed unity, an association of interests and egos enforced by law and custom and imposing an artificial constructed order in which the interests of some prevail over the interests of others, and only a half-accepted, half-enforced, half-natural, half-artificial accommodation keeps the social whole in being. Between community and community, there is a still worse accommodation with a constant recurrence of the strife of collective ego with collective ego. This is the best that we can do, and all our persistent readjustments of the social order can bring us nothing better than an imperfect structure of life. So this is a statement of where humanity is currently, without this farther evolution into Gnostic being. It is only if our nature develops beyond itself, if it becomes a nature of self-knowledge, mutual understanding, unity, a nature of true being and true life, that the result can be a perfection of ourselves and our existence, a life of true being, a life of unity, mutuality, harmony, a life of true happiness, a harmonious and beautiful life. So this goes back not to the spirit resting in itself in quietude. This is spirit in movement. This is the nature of spiritual reality. When that nature manifests, then you can achieve all these perfections. If our nature is fixed in what it is, what it has already become, then no perfection, no real and enduring happiness is possible in earthly life. We must seek it not at all and do the best we can with our imperfections, or we must seek it elsewhere in a supra-terrestrial hereafter, or we must go beyond all such seeking and transcend life by an extinction of nature and ego in some absolute from which this strange and unsatisfactory being of ours has come into existence. And these are the ordinary solutions that we've become familiar with over the last thousands of years. We accept the imperfections of life as it is, and oh well. Or we say, well, let's go to those lustrous heavens just above and beyond our reach. Or we quit it all and rise into the transcendence. But all of that leaves the world unchanged, the cosmic riddle unanswered. But if in us there is a spiritual being which is emerging, and our present state is only an imperfection of half emergence, if the inconscient is a starting point containing in itself the potency of a superconscience and supernature which has to evolve, a veil of apparent nescience in which that greater consciousness is concealed and from which it has to unfold itself. If an evolution of being is the law, then what we are seeking for is not only possible, but part of the eventual necessity of things. And did you see his sleight of hand? As a master of English, this is not an error, this is an intention. Superconscience and supernature which has to evolve. You would say normally, which have to evolve. But he has identified the two. The superconscience and the supernature are one. The awareness and the power of that awareness as a nature are the same thing, and so he gives it the singular treatment. It is our spiritual destiny to manifest and become that supernature. For it is the nature of our true self, our still occult because unevolved whole being. A nature of unity will then bring inevitably its life result of unity, mutuality, harmony. An inner life awakened to a full consciousness and to a full power of consciousness will bear its inevitable fruit in all who have it. Self-knowledge, a perfected existence, the joy of a satisfied being, the happiness of a fulfilled nature. So this is Satchit Ananda, brought from there to here and established in nature. All the apparent divisions between supernature and lower nature annihilated. A bridge built. A manifestation occurred. Remember, manifestation means that which is made clear. Always it was there, but to make it manifest is to make it stand out. So Satchit Ananda, finally, in the course of evolution, must exhibit the joy of a conscious existence. When you're aware of your true being, you are delighted. An innate character of the Gnostic consciousness and the instrumentation of supernature is a wholeness of sight and action, a unity of knowledge with knowledge, a reconciliation of all that seems contrary in our mental seeing and knowing, an identity of knowledge and will acting as a single power in perfect unison with the truth of things. This inborn character of supernature is the foundation of the perfect unity, mutuality, harmony of its action. In the mental being, there is a discord of its constructed knowledge with the real or the whole truth of things, so that even what is true in it is often or is eventually ineffective or only partially effective. Our discoveries of truth are overthrown. Our passionate effectuations of truth are frustrated. Often, the result of our action becomes part of a scheme we did not intend for a purpose whose legitimacy we would not acknowledge, or the truth of the idea is deceived by the actual outcome of its pragmatic success. How artfully he expresses it. Even if there is a successful realization of the idea, yet because the idea is incomplete, an isolated construction of the mind, separate from the one and whole truth of things, its success must sooner or later end in disillusionment and a new endeavor. The discordance of our seeing and our notions with the true truth and the whole truth of things, the partiality and superficiality of our mind's deceptive constructions, is the cause of our frustration. But there is also not only a discord of knowledge with knowledge, but of will with will, and of knowledge with will in the same being, a division and disharmony between them, so that where the knowledge is ripe or sufficient, some will in the being opposes it, or the will fails it. Where the will is powerful, vehement, or firmly or forcefully effective, knowledge guiding it to its right use is lacking. So here again, he's describing the nature of the current human equipment that we carry, a division between knowledge and will, which in Chit or in Chit Shakti are one and the same thing. All kinds of disparity and maladjustment and incompleteness of our knowledge, will, capacity, executive force, and dealing intervene constantly in our action, our working out of life, and are an abundant source of imperfection or ineffectivity. These disorders, defects, and disharmonies are normal to a status and energy of ignorance and can only be dissolved by a greater light than that of mind nature or life nature. An identity, an authenticity, and a harmony of truth with truth are the native character of all Gnostic seeing and action. As the mind grows into the Gnosis, our mental seeing and action, lifted into the Gnostic light or visited and ruled by it, would begin to partake of this character and, even if still restricted and within limits, must become much more perfect and, within these limits, effective. The causes of our incapacity and frustration would begin to diminish and disappear. But also, the larger existence will invade the mind with the potencies of a greater consciousness and a greater force, a bringing out of new powers of the being. Knowledge is power and act of consciousness. Will is conscious power and conscious act of force of being. Both in the Gnostic being will reach greater magnitudes than any we now know, a higher degree of themselves, a richer instrumentation. For wherever there is an increase of consciousness, there is an increase of the potential force and the actual power of the existence. So here he's not leaning on the term supramental, he's leaning on the term Gnostic, which is another equivalent, roughly, for the supramental consciousness as it grips and changes, fundamentally reconstructs the entity that carries the soul now, or that is the vehicle for the soul's conveyance. So what he's expressing here more powerfully is that these terms of being expressed as consciousness and power, expressed in consciousness as knowledge, in power as will, become fuller and fuller as they manifest. They get a grip, things change. More power, more untold potencies of being come out, and it gathers force. The manifestation through the supramental of the infinite riches of Satchit Ananda begin to grip the nature. In the terrestrial formulation of knowledge and power, this correlation, and correlation again, it's a state of shared relation, self with self. In the terrestrial formulation of knowledge and power, this correlation is not altogether apparent because there, consciousness itself is concealed in an original inconscience, and the natural strength and rhythm of its powers and their emergence are diminished and disturbed by the discordances and the veils of the ignorance. So, light above, lapsing through involution into the inconscience below, but always there is only light. So, within that absolute pitch black darkness of the inconscient must also be present light. It is there. The inconscient there is the original, potent, and automatically effective force. The conscious mind is only a small laboring agent, but that is because the conscious mind in us has a limited individual action, and the inconscient is an immense action of a universal, concealed consciousness. The cosmic force, masked as a material energy, hides from our view by its insistent materiality of process the occult fact that the working of the inconscient is really the expression of a vast universal life, a veiled universal mind, a hooded gnosis, and without these origins of itself, it could have no power of action, no organizing coherence. So this is the mystic truth of the universe. Despite the appearances, there is a greater reality manifesting through the forces of evolution. Life force, also in the material world, seems to be more dynamic and effective than mind. Our mind is free and fully powerful in idea and cognition only. Its force of action, its power of effectuation outside this mental field, is obliged to work with life and matter as instruments, and under the conditions imposed on it by life and matter, our mind is hampered and half effective. But even so, we see that nature force in the mental being is much more powerful to deal with himself and with life and matter than nature force in the animal. It is the greater force of consciousness and knowledge, the greater emerged force of being and will, that constitute this superiority. In human life itself, the vital man seems to have a stronger dynamis of action than the mental man because of his superiority in kinetic life force. The intellectual tends to be effective in thought but ineffective in power over the world, while the kinetic vital man of action dominates life. But it is his use of mind that enables him to arrive at a full exploitation of this superiority. And in the end, the mental man, by his power of knowledge, his science, is able to extend the mastery of existence far beyond what life and matter could accomplish by its own agencies, or what the vital man could accomplish with his life force and life instinct without that increase of effective knowledge. An immensely greater power over existence and over nature must come when a still greater consciousness emerges and replaces the hampered operations of the mental energy in our too individualized and restricted force of existence. So this Sri Aurobindo has traced out in his analysis of history as well, which you would find interesting reading. A certain fundamental subjection of mind to life and matter, and an acceptance of this subjection, an inability to make the law of mind directly dominant and modify by its powers the blinder law and operations of these inferior forces of being, remains even in the midst of our greatest mental mastery over self and things. But this limitation is not insuperable. It is the interest of occult knowledge that it shows us, and a dynamic force of spiritual knowledge brings us the same evidence, that this subjection of mind to matter, of the spirit to a lesser law of life, is not what it at first appears to be, a fundamental condition of things, an inviolable and unalterable rule of nature. The greatest, most momentous natural discovery that man can make is this, that mind, and still more the force of the spirit, can, in many tried and yet untried ways and in all directions, by its own nature and direct power, and not only by devices and contrivances, such as the superior material instrumentation discovered by physical science, overcome and control life and matter. So, consciousness, in other words, can act in and influence and alter and change its material form. What seems to be the master of consciousness is actually the instrument of consciousness. And this would follow out even in ancient Indian thinking in the Sankhya system, because there, mind as manas, buddhi, above the mind, can insist that the extensions of matter obey the behest of the conscious Purusha. In the evolution of the Gnostic supernature, this direct power of consciousness, this direct action of the force of the being, its free mastery and control of life and matter, would be consummated and reach their acme. For the greater knowledge of the Gnostic being would not be in the main an outwardly acquired or learned knowledge, but the result of an evolution of consciousness and of the force of consciousness, a new dynamization of the being. As a consequence, he would awake to and possess many things: a clear and complete knowledge of self, a direct knowledge of others, a direct knowledge of hidden forces, a direct knowledge of the occult mechanism of mind and life and matter, which are beyond our present attainment. This new knowledge, an action of knowledge, would be based on an immediate intuitive consciousness of things, and an immediate intuitive control of things, an operative insight, now supernormal to us, would be the normal functioning of this consciousness, and an integral assured effectivity, both in the mass of action and in its detail, would be the outcome of the change. So here is a complete knowledge, first of the self. So one knows one's soul, one knows one's spiritual essence and substance. And then, therefore, because it's not simply individual but unpartite, extending to all around, one knows the self of others. One understands the flow of energies operative in the cosmos. One understands the inner cosmic machinery. And one has an intuition. Remember, intuition to Sri Aurobindo is not just a surmise truthful of what might be true. It is the edge of a ray of truth. It is light from the supramental itself. And the supramental is the formulation, harmonically, of the conscious being of delight, which is Satchit Ananda. So this intuition penetrates, but also affects what it sees and wills. And so this is akin to the Ritta Chit, which we have met in the Veda. An operative insight. So this intuition, which penetrates, has the capacity to work, to dynamize what it sees, to make true what it wishes. For the Gnostic being would be in unison and communion with the consciousness force that is at the root of everything. His vision and his will would be the channel of the supramental real idea, the self-effective truth force. His action would be a free manifestation of the power and workings of the root force of existence, the force of an all-determining conscious spirit whose formulations of consciousness work out inevitably in mind, life, and matter. Acting in the light and power of the supramental knowledge, the evolving Gnostic being would be more and more master of himself, master of the forces of consciousness, master of the energies of nature, master of his instrumentation of life and matter. In the lesser status, the intermediate stages or formations of the evolving Gnostic nature, this power would not be present in its fullness. But in some degree of its activities, it would be there, incipient and increasing with the ascent of the scale. It would be a natural concomitant of the growth of consciousness and knowledge. Concomitant, companion, from comitare in Latin, to accompany. And thus, the supramental gains ascendance in the world. I think it's a great place to put our bookmarks for the nonce, and we'll carry it farther in our next meeting. We expect to finish the Life Divine just before, just after Sri Aurobindo's birthday this year. So this is a section from Savitri. Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. Life kept no more a dull and meaningless shape. In the struggle and upheaval of the world, he saw the labor of a Godhead's birth, a secret knowledge masked as ignorance, fate covered with an unseen necessity, the game of chance of an omnipotent will, a glory and a rapture and a charm, the all-blissful sat unknown within the heart. Earth's pains were the ransom of its prison delight. A glad communion tinged the passing hours. The days were travelers on a destined road, the nights companions of his musing spirit. A heavenly impetus quickened all his breast. The trudge of time changed to a splendid march. The divine dwarf towered to unconquered worlds. Earth grew too narrow for his victory. Once, only registering the heavy tread of a blind power on human littleness, life now became a sure approach to God, existence a divine experiment, and cosmos, the soul's opportunity. The world was a conception and a birth of spirit in matter into living forms, and nature bore the immortal in her womb that she might climb through him to eternal life. His being lay down in bright, immobile peace and bathed in wells of pure spiritual light. It wandered in wide fields of wisdom self, lit by the rays of an everlasting sun. Even his body's subtle self within could raise the earthly parts towards higher things and feel on it the breath of heavenlier air. Already it journeyed towards divinity, a buoyed upon winged winds of rapid joy, upheld to a light it could not always hold, It left minds distanced from the truth supreme and lost life's incapacity for bliss. All now suppressed in us began to emerge. Much love. Namaste, Jai Ma.